I'm joined by Diane Mitch Bush, who is running to represent the 3rd Congressional District. How are you, Diane?
I'm great. Beautiful fall day and some snow. We got to drive through some snow. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for coming. And we were just talking about your endorsement from the Durango Herald. Congratulations.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you.
Now, how has it been? Just on a general human level, we're getting close now to the election. How are you feeling? How's it looking for you?
I've been doing this for 17 months, and one of the most wonderful things about it has been seeing our big, beautiful district and listening to some wonderful people. You know, we hear so much these days about how people are bought, sold, and paid for, or they're just thinking of themselves, or they're this, or they're that. People that I've met work hard for their communities and in their communities. They're caring, compassionate people who want better lives, both for themselves, for sure, but for everybody.
If everybody in the district could know one thing about you, what would it be?
I always listen to my constituents and I fight for my constituents. That's what I did as a state house rep for 3 terms, and that's what I did as a rural county commissioner for 2 terms. That's the job. You listen, you defend, you fight, you work for your people, not for lobbyists, not for party leadership, not for big donors, but for your people.
And the incumbent Republican Scott Tipton has painted you as an extreme liberal. How do you respond to that criticism?
Well, I guess if I were as extreme as he claims I am, that my face can't even fit on the page of his mailer because I'm, quote, so far to the left, then I'm really perplexed because over 80% of my bills in the Colorado House had me and a Republican as co-prime, not just co-sponsors, but co-prime. A lot of you know Bob Rankin. I've worked with him a lot. I worked with a lot of Western Slope and rural lawmakers on policy, on bills to create policy that made people's lives better. And I'm very proud of that. And that's what I really believe I bring to this race and will bring to the U.S. Congress. This Congress has been dysfunctional. It's been totally ideological and partisan, partisan, partisan. What we need is a Congress where we can put our ego aside at the door and we can also get away from that party identification so much and just look at the bill. It doesn't matter if it's a, quote, Republican bill, i.e. done by a Republican, or a Democratic bill done by a Democrat. Does it work for our people? Do the policies that a bill creates help our people? If they don't, I'll vote against it. If they do, I'll vote for it. And that's how I was in the Colorado House. And I was very, you know, proud of that record. So I am really befuddled by all of these accusations. I know what they are. It's an election year. And that's all they have on me because I've been a person of great integrity and transparency and accountability. And so what they've got is the fact that I subscribed to a magazine that in the 70s called itself socialist. It doesn't call itself that anymore. It hasn't called itself that for many years. It's called In These Times. And it does wonderful in-depth stories on neighborhoods and communities throughout our country and throughout the world, actually, who are trying themselves to make their lives and their neighbors' lives better. They don't call themselves socialists. They talk about economic justice and social justice. And that's what I'm all about.
What is this magazine?
In These Times.
In These Times.
It's out of Chicago.
Okay.
Yeah,
and they dug that up from the 70s,
where
they had and you continue to subscribe, but it was once called the Socialist.
Well, its masthead used to say Socialist in the masthead, but then, you know, they changed it shortly after that, actually, because it wasn't a party or a party platform. It was trying to understand how people working together in their own local communities can improve everyone's lives in that community. That's what it was all about. And so it was about fighting corruption, fighting pollution, fighting against corporations that were dismantling communities in the 80s and in the 90s and still. So it wasn't a socialist in the political sense at all. It was, I would say, community and trying to inform other people in other places that might share those kinds of problems, how these other folks have done it. Maybe you can take something from it. And they also say that I funded it. I was a subscriber.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so it's like, whatever.
What is your strategy for diffusing that sense of partisanship?
I have one of our flyers that have come out in the mail this week in my backpack. I don't have it in the room with you. I can show it to you after. But on one side of them, I talk about, or actually people in my district talk about how Tipton's votes have negatively affected them, veterans, seniors, women. And then on the other side, it's me talking about what I want to do and how I want to bring people together and how I will be a champion for all the people, not just some.
Is it true that you haven't taken PAC money?
I took a pledge, a promise to not take corporate PAC money. Okay. So I've not taken corporate PAC money, zero. His FEC reports will show and have shown that he takes lots of corporate PAC money. And when you look at what corporations they are, it's a who's who of Wall Street and a who's who of corporate polluters worldwide, as well as, you know, some other kinds of corporations. I do take interest group PAC money. From women's groups, environmental groups, teachers groups, good government watchdog groups, and Citizens United has given me money, and groups like that. Hmm. And they're also PACs, but they're not corporate PACs.
Okay. And Citizens United, that's, what is that?
Citizens United is an organization that began in response to the Citizens United Supreme Court decision, which, among other things, reinforces a previous opinion of the court that corporations are people. But more importantly, that decision allows so-called independent expenditure groups to not have to report who was donated to them and to whom they've donated, and donations to them and from them are unlimited.
Well, getting down to policy, what are your top priorities if elected?
We need an economy that works for everyone, not just the top 1%. People in the 3rd Congressional District of Colorado are struggling. We haven't partaken in the economic boom that we've seen in the Front Range, and now we're hearing about how the economy is so great because, you know, the stock market is so great and we have low unemployment. Well, a lot of people in this district work for wages. They don't have stocks. And low unemployment does not necessarily mean living wage jobs, and that's a real problem in our district. Secondly, this administration has, from almost day one, entered into an outright assault on our environment, on science-based environmental protections. They deny that climate change exists, and therefore they don't think we need to do anything about it. Or now Tipton has said it exists, but it's not necessarily caused by humans. Well, scientific evidence since at least the 1950s and indeed in the late 1800s has shown that industrial fossil fuel burning raises the temperature. And we can argue about that all we want, but it is a scientific finding that has come up again and again. 97% of scientists who study in this area believe that we must tackle climate change now. A recent UN report 2 days ago showed that temperatures are rising faster than we had thought. So that's a key piece under the environment. But bringing back, for example, methane rules, this administration scrapped them. They're critical. So that's important. And then, of course, healthcare issues. That's my third. So it's an economy that works for everyone, protecting the environment and public health, and a healthcare system that actually delivers for people without bankrupting them. Healthcare emergencies are the leading cause of personal family bankruptcy in the United States. That is not the case anywhere else in the industrialized world, nowhere else. And we are the only country that does not have some form, and they differ, of universal single-payer insurance. And, you know, my opponent likes to talk about me being for government-run healthcare. No, that is not government-run healthcare. It's insurance, just like current Medicare is insurance. You can choose your doctor. You can buy additional policies from a variety of different companies, sell additional supplemental policies. This would look similar. And one bill, particular H.R. 676, I think would be a really good bill that bases its insurance coverage on a Medicare-like system. Now, again, other countries, it runs the gamut. In Britain, we have something that more closely resembles the VA, where the government actually is the healthcare provider, not just the insurer. In Canada, the government provides healthcare insurance, and you go to your doctor, you do whatever. In Australia, it's a similar system. And Switzerland and Germany, they're a little, those systems cover everyone, but they're a little more integrated with employers, not the way our current system is, but they're just, they're different methods of doing it. So A, it's not one size fits all, and B, it's not, quote, government run. And C, my opponent in two debates keeps using this discredited figure that it will cost us $32 trillion. That figure is from the Mercatus Institute, which is a, quote, please put it in quotes, research organization funded by the Koch brothers. That is the only study, and I've read a number of them. I haven't read all of them, but I've read five of the key studies, including that one. And that study does not account for any cost savings that would accrue to us, according to other researchers, other economists. So lots of different studies, and they do have different figures, but all of them except Mercatus agree that we would save money because costs would be lower, especially administrative red tape.
Should the House flip and the Senate? What about getting the signature of the president?
Right. I think the key there in 2019 and 2020 is that we work across the aisle. And I come very well prepared to do that because I've done it in the Colorado House. If we can work with our moderate Republican colleagues and get some common sense bills that solve problems, whether it's environmental issues, workplace issues, agriculture issues, healthcare issues, and incentivizing small businesses in our communities, whatever it is, these should be common sense, evidence-based bills that we can get a high level of agreement on and enough votes to overturn a veto. So let him veto. Mm-hmm. And it's at his peril if he wants to win in 2020. Because what I'm talking about are not wild, crazy. I've been characterized as wild, crazy extremists, and people who know me just laugh because I'm a wonk. I'm a numbers person. My PhD's in quantitative policy analysis. I love regression equations. And, you know, lobbyists would say to me, Donald, well, here are the facts. I go, don't show me the facts. Let me find out the facts on my own, please. You know, this is what the data show. No, no, no. You show me the data, I'll tell you what the data show. So I think we need that kind of legislation.
You mentioned agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
The Farm Bill,
God.
Although the Senate passed a bipartisan version,
yep.
That the Rocky Mountain Farmers
yep.
Union
yep.
approved of, the House did not pass a version.
Yep.
So what is your reaction to that? You have been a champion of local agriculture
yep.
in the past.
Yes, and I stress that in the House and as a county commissioner, because Rouse County is an agricultural county. And I'm very proud to have been named Legislator of the Year in 2015 by the Rocky Mountain Farmers Union and by the Colorado Livestock Association, which is more conservative. Let's leave it at that. I was astounded and frankly disappointed. This is an administration and a Congress that has said again and again that agriculture matters. They won largely because of votes from family ranchers and farmers. And yet they're working against the interests, the economic and cultural and community interests of family ranchers and farmers. For example, in the FY18 budget and the FY19 budget, first, the Department of Agriculture was the third or the fourth biggest set of cuts. Those cuts included cuts to low-interest small business rural loans, cuts to the Conservation Reserve Program and EKIP, another conservation program that a lot of ranchers and farmers use. And then we have the tariffs. The tariffs hurt American agriculture. Excuse me, and they really hurt Colorado agriculture, especially beef exports, but other commodities. You know, as you know, commodity prices fluctuate violently. You know, one rancher once said, I was asking this one rancher if he would go to a certain casino if it were built. And he says, Diane, I gamble every day. I don't need to go gamble at a casino. I mean, that's what farming and ranching are. They're very, very difficult businesses to be in. And so this administration has actually hurt family ranching and farming. Now, they may have helped big agribusiness or the pesticide manufacturers, but I'm for small family ranches and farms. They're the heart and soul of so many of our communities, and they provide food for the people.
What is your stance on the Jordan Cove pipeline?
No demand has been proven for that LNG liquid natural gas. That's the reason that FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, denied the permit in 2016. The situation has gotten worse, actually, since global natural gas prices have become more volatile, one, and two, because Russia has entered into contracts, long-term contracts, with both China and Japan, who would be the major importers of LNG. Now, that's not to say we couldn't either, but nonetheless, it doesn't look like a certain market. Now, some, the Grand Junction Chamber, when they interviewed me, said, oh, there are long-term letters of intent. A letter of intent is not a contract. Okay, it's not the same thing. It also worries me, frankly, that Colorado Labor is going to be non-existent on the pipeline itself because it's in Oregon, mm-hmm. as is the facility. I mean, we already have the pipeline that goes to Malin, Oregon. But where those who are supporters of Jordan Cove see jobs is in the Piance Basin in Rio Blanco and Garfield counties. First, the demand isn't assured. And second, if you know anything about oil and gas, which I know a bit because I'm from an oil and gas county and also served, you know, in the State House, the new jobs that are created are primarily created in the exploration and drilling process. Those are often out-of-state workers, roughnecks from Wyoming or Louisiana or Texas or whatever, and they're temporary jobs. So you'll see a big boost in jobs, which is why Rio Blanco County had to start building man camps in the 90s because they had this huge influx of exploration and drilling people. Then if you do hit gas, then the monitoring system is much more computer run and often from afar. So you have fewer jobs. So expands jobs, contracts jobs. And those first jobs in the expansion are not necessarily local people. They may be. So to me, there are so many more questions than there are answers about this project. And if I could get better answers, you know, I'll look at it again. But right now, I don't have any evidence that shows me that this is going to create high-paying jobs. I have plenty of evidence that shows me that solar installers, energy auditors, solar manufacturing businesses, community solar gardens, all create many more permanent jobs. As does, by the way, outdoor manufacturing.
Diane Mitch Bush, thank you so much for joining me at KDNK.
Thank you, and thanks to everybody listening.